we're going to do everything by consensus until we get a quorum. So let's do roll call first. Okay.
Brenda Arnold. Sally Channon.
Here.
Michael Howe. Jean Matthews. Michael Owens. Gary Dunmire is excused. Bogdan Kriokowski is excused. And Neil is excused. Olga Prieto. Bob Sabin.
Here.
Mark Stivers. Heather Trebeau.
Here.
Andy Delgado.
Here.
Okay, so no quorum, right?
No quorum.
Okay, great. So the next is going to be by consensus. It's for the agenda for today, but I think there's a couple changes.
Yeah, the minus item 3A.
So we're going to strike item 3A for the Okeechobee Corridor study. Okay, so can we adopt by consensus? All in favor?
Yep.
Aye.
Okay. And then can we adopt by consensus? Oh wait, we're going to actually defer the meeting minutes from July 13th. So then we're going to go from the comments to the chair. Just hope everyone had a safe time and there's not a lot of work that everyone has to do from the hurricane. I think that everyone responded, right? I hope that everyone's cities is safe and have lots of safe residents with power. And then we're going to get to item F. Any comments from the general public? I don't see anyone from the general public. Okay, thank you. And then we're going to get right to our action items. Item number 2A is a motion for approval of the 2018-2022 TIP. It'll be presented by Andrew.
Good morning, everyone. So my name is Andrew Euler. I'm the PIP coordinator.
Sure.
This will only take a second. There is no presentation. But in the packet, in the back of the packet you see on the screen here, this is what it looks like. These are projects that were in the fiscal year 17 through 21 TIP that were planned to be spent in that fiscal year 17 year. And they haven't been spent yet since by July 30th, so they'll be rolled into the fiscal year 18 through 22. So a lot of these projects are moving from fiscal year 17 to fiscal year 18, or at least phases of them. There is no presentation on any project specifically. A lot of these are smaller ones, just moving phases backward. Just one I wanted to highlight was the State Road 7 project, and that's the first one in the packet. And the one thing I wanted to say about that is it's been brought up from past meetings about how the funding was playing out for that one. So there was federal funds attached to State Road 7 that weren't obligated yet. So they used those funds, they transferred those funds to FDOT did to State Road 80 project. And then we're using other funds now in fiscal year 18 for State Road 7. And that's just the first project there. And that's really about it. A lot of these projects are small, as I mentioned, and mostly moving from fiscal year 17 to fiscal year 18. Are there any questions about that?
State Route 80. Okay, so it's good. That project's still continuing. Never mind.
Correct. This is a point. None of these are new projects. So these were ones that were in the TIP before. Just phasing is changing.
Anyone else have any questions? By consensus, is it a vote or anyone have any?
Do we have consensus?
We have
stage rolling forward.
The City of West Palm, of course, with State Road 7 is, again, State Road 7, it goes through a lot of catchment areas, so the city would not be in support of any amendments that has the State Road 7 on it. Is there consensus amongst the rest of the group?
Consensus minus one.
Huh?
Consensus minus one.
Consensus minus one. There you go. Okay, thank you, Andrew. Okay, so our next item is item B. It's State Road 80 Corridor Action Plan Update. Ms. Peanut.
All right, so good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm going to do a brief introduction of this project. The project team from FDOT couldn't be here this morning. They actually want to do a full presentation of this to you next month when you have a full quorum and then everyone can participate. But I wanted to give you a kind of a quick overview of the alternatives being considered because they feed into the I-95 interchange at State Road 80, and that's the next item on your agenda. So, quick background on the State Road 80 corridor action plan. We're going to cover the purpose, the process, the alternatives development, and where we go from here. Purpose is to recommend actions to be taken by DOT, local governments, and other stakeholders to protect and enhance the strategic intermodal system, or SIS corridor. They're looking at improving upon and preserving access and mobility for all users, considering multimodal strategies to meet demand safely and efficiently, identifying strategies to ensure mobility, and we're going through this whole process. I want to stop here and say we included two other pieces of information beyond the presentation in your backup backup material for the meeting. Piece of information number one was excerpts from the Strategic Intermodal System Unfunded Needs Plan. The Unfunded Needs Plan shows two big project concepts for State Road 80 from roughly 20-mile bend east to I-95. One of those concepts was introduction of a light rail service that they said would cost about $1 billion. The other concept was a managed lane project that they said would cost about $1 billion. Part of this corridor action plan's challenge is to identify which of those two concepts should move forward into project development, environmental assessment, design, right-of-way acquisition, and construction. So that's background to this whole exercise. Placeholders for two big investments with the challenge for the action plan to evaluate which of those two major outcomes should be moving forward into a project. Fast forward to January, February of this year, and I want to mention that the other item in your backup material is the letter from DOT saying that the transit outcome from the SIS unfunded needs plan will not be moving forward for consideration. The corridor doesn't have the right land use, you don't have a dedicated source for operating funds, you don't have an identified source for capital funds, and you don't have a plan that says you want to invest in light rail service on State Road 80. Therefore, the light rail project goes off the table, and the corridor action plan now is envisioning what the roadway alternative needs to look like. I wanted to give you that kind of background perspective because that's feeding into what kind of a project are we looking for on State Road 80. Importance of the SIS, it is the high priority network vital to the state's economy, and State Road 80 is this road right here that connects all the way on the east end from the town of Palm Beach all the way on the west end to Sanibel Island, Fort Myers. It's one of the key east-west corridors that connect across the state of Florida. There have been over $346 million of improvements invested in the corridor since 2005. I actually came to Palm Beach County in 2003 when Southern Boulevard was still a five-lane road. It was two lanes eastbound, two lanes westbound, and a center turn lane, and there was no overpasses at State Road 7, no overpasses at Haverhill Military, Jog Road didn't even make the map on this graphic, but there's an overpass here now, and there's one at Congress, and it functions really like a partial limited access facility today. There are $117 million of program future investments in the corridor, widening of the corridor from Forest Hill Boulevard to the Arden Project west of Lion Country Safari from four lanes to six lanes, the addition of turn lanes at the Forest Hill intersection, the addition of turn lanes at the State Road 7 intersection, the addition of turn lanes at the Sansbury's Way intersection, turn lanes at the Turnpike, and this circle should actually cover both Pike Road and the Turnpike intersections, and interchange improvements that are going to be talked about in the next agenda item. So these are all funded projects in the next 5 years. They'll be constructed. They're turn lanes and major widening in the western part of the corridor. There's also a lot of future development coming in this area. Thousands of new homes. We're looking at the Arden Project, which I referenced earlier. There's a commercial development here at the FPL substation power plant and Palm Beach Aggregate site. with commercial warehouse server farm. This is the Westlake community. This is the Indian Trail Groves community that has land use to build another 4,500 homes, but withdrew their zoning petition. That's the project that's been in conversation about what if we make this agricultural reserve and put all the development rights that we've now achieved on this land in the ag reserve area in the West Boynton, West Delray part of Palm Beach County. We also have maybe smaller but not inconsequential, the annexation in Royal Palm on the south side of Southern Boulevard, just west of State Road 7 for development purposes, and then some other, I think there's the Cypress Key community right there that is developing multifamily housing as well as some non-residential development on the State Road 80 corridor. Study process, this is a planning study. It's just looking at what should we build. This is not project development. It's not environmental assessment. It's not design. It doesn't acquire right-of-way. So from plan to this point right here where concept gets ironed out and design gets worked out and construction happens is at least 10 years. So we're 10 years away from seeing any of these concepts being implemented. Good to remember as we just embark down the planning journey. The plan goes through a data collection process, analysis and alternatives development, public workshop for alternatives, an action plan report, and then finally adoption of the action plan. Multimodal alternative development first focused on the long list of strategies and feasibility of tier one alternatives. That's when the transit option was still part of the conversation. Then that was excluded in the development of feasible strategies that became alternatives for tier two evaluation, and that's where we are right now. I'm jumping ahead. So looking at the eastern section first, from 20 Mile Bend to Congress Avenue, which is just west of I-95, there are three key alternatives that we're going to review. The first one is a signalized arterial with what we're going to call our alternative intersections. And actually, at this point, Marge, I'm going to let you switch from this presentation to the video, and we'll play a piece of that because I want you to understand how these alternative intersections are supposed to work. So, basic concept is if you are traveling on a crossing street and you want to make a left turn onto the main road, instead of making that left turn at this traffic signal, you are now going to make a right turn, cross over to this point in the median, and then make a signalized U-turn when this main line is stopped. You'll make the U-turn, and then you'll be able to travel westbound onto that main corridor. So this would be like a Sainsbury's Way and a Southern Boulevard. So if I'm traveling southbound on Sainsbury's and I want to go east on Southern, I would have to make a right turn to go west and then make this carved out U-turn to go back to the east. The same thing happens if I'm on Southern Boulevard traveling home from West Palm Beach and I want to go south on Sainsbury's Way. I would go through the Sainsbury's intersection as a through movement, get into this U-turn, make the U-turn, and then come back here and make the right to go down Southern, down Sainsbury's Way. The idea here is that both the main intersection that remains as a signal and these two new intersections that are introduced as signals are both what's called two-phase traffic signals. So there's one movement goes, then the other one goes, and then back. They operate more efficiently than a traditional four-phase or eight-phase signal where you have all those left turns happening, where you have to stop the through movements and then start the lefts and then stop the lefts and start the throughs. They operate a little bit smoother, and they allow the main road to carry a lot more traffic. They also provide for pedestrian refuge islands and safe crossing maneuvers for all the pedestrians and potential cyclists that might choose to operate in the corridor. So you've got some folks who are actually crossing the intersections here. They're a little bit less convenient for motorists because now you're being forced to make a right turn and then a U-turn in order to make a left, but they do operate more efficiently as a corridor. Any questions on this concept before we move away from it? Bob?
So do bicycles go with the main flow of traffic, or do they go
separately with the walkers.
So if I'm a cyclist coming through here and I want to make that left turn, I'm going to suggest that it's best to become a pedestrian at this point, cross the intersection in the crosswalk, cross it again in the crosswalk, and then re-enter the roadway surface and go south here. I don't think it's, at the speeds that this corridor are going to promote, it's not a good idea for you to cross over to the U-turn lane and make that U-turn maneuver.
So this, the frequency of the light switch, changing the light switches, is about the same, but it's one time for everybody. Or more things happen all at once, I guess.
Right. So your east-west throughs happen, and that, so we'll say the intersection is about 3 minutes. The cycle is about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
So you get about a minute and a half now of east-west through movement, and then a minute and a half of north-south through. Or maybe if the east-west is the really heavy one, you get 2 minutes east-west, and then you're only stopped for 1 minute before you're back to 2 minutes of east-west through again.
With this one versus the other one, you have to wait for the left-hand turns, and so
correct.
You have less time.
Yeah, okay. So of your 3 minutes, your through movement on a traditional might be about 40% of that, so maybe 100 and... I don't know.
Yeah.
But 80 seconds, we'll say. So your through movement might be 80 seconds, and then for the other 100 seconds, you're stopped. You're waiting for those left turns to go northbound to the west, southbound to the east, and then you're waiting for the westbound lefts to go in front of you, and then you get a chance to go again. So the idea is that this just makes everything happen a little more efficiently. The other part of it is through movements happen faster, as where turning vehicles can only go about 9 miles per hour on a right turn, 15 miles per hour on a left turn. The through movements, they can go through there at 40, 45, 50 miles per hour. So you can process more vehicles at the same time.
Okay.
Other questions on this? So this is the funkiest, if you will, but potentially least expensive alternative of the three being considered. All right, Marge, jump us back to the other presentation. Okay, so these, what are called alternative intersections, would be proposed at Forest Hill, at Royal Palm, just east of Royal Palm, at Lamstein, and then again here at Fairgrounds, at Lyons, at Benoist, at the Turnpike intersections, here at Cleary. Then you keep the grade separations between Cleary and Kirk, and then you do another one at Kirk Road. So all of the traffic signals that exist today through this whole section become alternative intersections. That's the concept. With the understanding that you would kind of try to provide for those continuous pedestrian and bicycle facilities.
How far, what's the distance from the intersection that we're leaving from the signalization to where the turnaround is? What's that general distance?
500 to 800 feet.
500 to 800 feet.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's not huge.
But there's an issue with access. Like, you have those major intersections, and so you start limiting access to the land use that's around it at that point. So it changes what happens there. And then now we're taking that, moving that same issue with land use 500 and 800 feet away, where those businesses would tend to be successful as it relates to access. So it'll change that dynamic, because that's what I'm asking. Okay.
I think you're right. It will. As you get out to the western area, you've got a little bit more commercial activity on the corridor. You have a bit at Lyons Road, the Fairgrounds intersection. You don't have a ton today, and the Benoist Turnpike and Cleary intersections. You don't have a ton of commercial access or activities, which incidentally is part of why transit didn't work very well, because we don't have very much stuff on the corridor, so it was hard to service many people or jobs with a transit service that would operate within the right-of-way, because you're far from where everyone wants to go or where they begin their trips. But I think you're right to observe that would be an impact of this project. Okay, so that's alternative one. And part of the reason I wanted to introduce this is because I want you to begin thinking through the pedestrian bicycle infrastructure needs and options that should be suggested to be included as part of a corridor project like this. Okay, we just did the video, and this is what the typical section would look like on the roadway. And what I want to point out here is this is a relatively little change to the typical section. So you look at the overall right-of-way. The top is the existing condition. So you've got your eight-lane road, east, four lanes eastbound, four lanes westbound, with just a standard bike lane, sidewalk on this side, standard bike lane, guardrail, and then sidewalk. And then proposed, now they're saying, well, let's go to a 7-foot buffered bike lane as well as a 12-foot shared-use path on what would be the south side of the roadway, stay with the 6-foot sidewalk and the buffered bike lane on the north side of the roadway. So that's the suggested alternative. Now, what this doesn't show is those places where you would need to make the U-turns, then you're going to have a bulb out and some impacts at those locations. Yes?
On that last slide, were there some parallel facilities that needed to be built for bicycles? Or was that just network enhancement?
Are you talking about these blue dashed lines?
Yes.
The blue dashed lines, I believe, are recommended
network enhancements?
Parallel facility projects, but they're not on State Road 80 and they wouldn't be built by the DOT.
Okay.
So like a connection from State Road 7 to Jog Road might be a good idea, but it's not going to be constructed by DOT.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what the other... Is it... I'm trying to put names to them.
Is it Summit? That one, the south one is Summit.
It might, yeah, it could be the extension of Summit Boulevard all the way west from Jog over to... over the turnpike. Right here,
oh, is that other one
connecting to Lyons, and then this one might be
Gun Club,
or I want to say, is it Dillman Road?
No.
Yeah, so the idea is that you would connect two more roadways over the turnpike that don't go over it today in order to provide parallel facilities to relieve Southern Boulevard. But those are not roads controlled by the DOT, so there are suggestions that the county would go forward with if they chose to. And then same thing up here, improvements on Belvedere. The DOT said, wouldn't it be nice if Belvedere became a more desirable facility all the way from Military Trail to I-95. Today it's a 6-lane road, so I'm not sure what their network enhancements entailed, but that was their other corridor identified. Okay, so that's signalized arterial with alternative intersections. Now we get to alternative two. Alternative two says, wherever you have a grade separated intersection, keep it, and wherever you don't, make it one. So now all the traffic signals that exist today on the corridor now become proposed grade separations, these yellow points. So Royal Palm, Lamstein, 103rd, all the way to all of these intersections on State Road 80 between Royal Palm Beach and State Road 7 now become grade-separated interchanges, with the exception of Forest Hill Boulevard, which is the last alternative intersection where they eliminate the left turns and just make you make rights and U's instead. So once you get east of Forest Hill Boulevard, now you're going up in the air. The study forgot that there's a approved access point right here with a potential signal to be installed, so that will probably get converted to an alternative intersection. But then once you get east of Royal Palm Beach Boulevard, you've got grade separations at Lyons, and you either eliminate or separate every other signal in the corridor. So Fairgrounds Road goes away, Lyons becomes an interchange. Benoist becomes an interchange. Pike becomes an interchange. The Turnpike Access becomes an interchange. Cleary becomes an interchange. Keep the grade separated interchanges at these three locations. Kirk Road becomes an interchange. And you get all the way to the project you're going to hear about next before you find your way into another traffic signal. So almost I-95 is the proposed option for alternative two. This one, in order to accommodate the access to all those removed traffic signals and to get you to and from the interchanges that you've now created, they're introducing frontage roads on the south side and on the north side of the main corridor. So you've got a 6-lane center arterial with continuous flow, and then you've got access to and from these frontage roads. And what you notice here is the right-of-way width for the existing corridor is inadequate to accommodate this design, so there's a lot of land that needs to be acquired along the corridor on the north side in order to provide for the frontage roads. This is a total corridor rebuild, very costly with respect to right-of-way acquisition and for construction, as well as the number of bridges that it introduces in the corridor. Questions about alternative two?
Question. How much additional right-of-way is
that? I don't know.
It says in fine print down there.
Yeah.
It's in the fine print.
Right.
I can't see it from here.
270.
270 versus 180 or something today? So 90 feet, maybe?
Okay. 160.
160, so maybe 110.
Okay. Thank you.
Bike path facilities, you still have the sidewalk on the north side. You have a buffered bike lane on the frontage road. You have a buffered bike lane on the south side in the frontage road. And then you have a 12-foot shared use path. 10-foot shared use path? It's hard for me to read that. I think it's a 12. 12-foot shared use path on the south side. Mm-hmm. So bike path facilities would be continuous on the frontage roads. They would not go on the overpasses, which means that all you cyclists that like to ride fast would be subjected to all the traffic signals that remain because you're running on the frontage roads. You wouldn't get to go on the interchanges. You're not supposed to go on the interchanges today. I've seen people do it, but the merge back into the outside lane on the downside of the hill is a harried experience. It's not one that I would recommend.
So everybody moving from the frontage road to the main road, extended road, they all have to make a left-hand merge into that at some point in time.
Sure. So if I were coming off of an intersection here and I was traveling eastbound and I wanted to get onto State Road 80, there would be a merging point somewhere along the corridor where I would go from the frontage road into the main line. And in fact, there are designated points of access, what they're calling main line access points, on the corridor. So you would be able to get into the main corridor at Royal Palm, at State Road 7, at Lyons, at the Turnpike, at Jog, Haverhill, or Military. If you were going onto the frontage roads anywhere else, you would have to travel on the frontage road system until one of those blue points in the corridor, and then you would be able to get onto the main line.
Okay. So, but those are traffic lights when you get to those points.
Frontage roads will intersect with traffic signals, yes. On the ground.
On the ground.
Right, but the main line would be going over. So if I came on Benoist and I wanted to go...
Oh, okay.
Say, if I'm southbound on Benoist Park, which is somewhere in this vicinity, and I want to go east on Southern Boulevard, I would go under the bridge, make a left turn onto the frontage road, pass through a signalized intersection here at Pike Road, and then once I get past Pike Road, I would be able to get into the main line.
Okay, you're losing me. But you're basically saying that the frontage roads are higher in elevation.
The frontage roads are on the ground.
On the ground.
Yes.
And the other ones are above.
Yes.
And so they...
But
so
the center lanes are going up over the interchanges, over the yellow and the blue dots.
Yeah.
And then coming back down on the other side. So it's a little bit of a roller coaster as you're going down the corridor. You're going up, you're going down, you're going up, you're going down. Now, alternative three gets rid of the roller coaster. So alternative three says, let's make everything in the corridor a grade separation. But instead of having the main line go up and down and up and down, let's just put it up in the air. And it's probably best to illustrate with the graphic. So at this point, this is a four-lane express corridor that is continuous and elevated. And then there's a remaining six-lane at-grade frontage system or roadway system. What happens here is you're only able to get into the elevated roadway in these designated places. At the west end, at State Road 7, at the Turnpike, at Jog, at Haverhill and Military. So you actually have less entry points to that elevated roadway than in the previous, which allows them to keep it up in the air and minimize the cost of getting you to and from it. All of your non-motorized facilities are on the ground as part of the six-lane remaining arterial road. So 6-foot sidewalk, 7-foot buffer bike lane in the westbound direction on the north side of the road, and then 7-foot buffered bike lane, 12-foot shared use path in the eastbound direction on the south side of the road. Questions about this, Heather?
Do they need 6 lanes on the bottom? Because there was a 2 lanes on the second alternative and then 3 lanes on the third?
So,
yeah.
In this one, they've got 3 in the middle and 2 on the outside. Whoa.
And the 3 are the path, the fly-throughs, and then the 2 are the local streets, right? But on the third one, it makes it look like the local streets are just as big as the highway again. There you go.
Right, so now you've got a shift where you only have 2 lanes in the free flow and 3 on the bottom.
But
because the bottom's being stopped a little more frequently.
Okay. But, I mean, it just doesn't make... I mean, that doesn't completely make sense. Like, so they're assuming that if you do it this way, that more people would travel down low, whereas before you were assuming more people would travel...
Well, because you're limiting the points you can get in and out
okay.
on this alternative. So, yeah, you do have more people coming and going because you're only able to get in here, 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 and here.
Okay. And then what's the right-of-way? Is there any right-of-way difference?
So the idea with this one is that it does fit... within the existing right-of-way. So this line stays constant. And you can provide all of this stuff with the caveat that this is a cantilevered elevated roadway. So you put the supports in the middle, and then you build the deck so that it sticks out over the existing travel lanes without being supported on the edges.
How many miles is it?
Ten? From Forest Hill to 95? I'm guessing. How far west is 95 from the coast?
7 miles.
Because Forest Hill is about 13 miles from the coast, and I think 95 is about 3 or 4. Yeah. So, 9 or 10 miles of elevated roadway.
The speed, there's a speed differential. The design speed now on the lower level is 45 miles an hour, where it used to be a 50 mile an hour speed.
Yes.
But what do you expect? There's going to be tend to slow it down anyway. I mean, what in previous experience, how much slowing down of the lower level do you end up getting, I guess, is what I want to say.
I don't know.
Capacity is going to be, its capacity is going to be decreased because of lower speeds, so that you got a lot more space in the upper one. So,
yeah, I would expect the upper speed... the design speed to be in the 65 to 70 range.
It says, I can't quite read it.
It says to be determined, but I don't think...
That's what it's... Okay.
I think it's supposed to be a 70.
Yeah, depends on how wide you make it.
Yeah, it's going to be a freeway-type design with controlled entrance and exit points and long ramp merge and diverge.
It's going to feel like a tunnel underneath. That's one of the things that happens to it.
It is, and... I think part of the reason I wanted to have this discussion this morning because I knew it would be a smaller group. I think that one of the questions that I want this committee in particular to wrestle with is what kind of non-motorized facility should you really be desiring here? If this is a design speed of 45 and it ends up being a 6-lane, 3 in each direction type of an experience, is the standard DOT 7-foot buffered bike lane, 2 white stripes next to a travel lane for cars, is that really the kind of investment that we want to make to attract continuous cyclists to the corridor? Or is there something else that should be considered?
And one of the things that crossed my mind is instead of trying to move the cars up, what if you move the bikes and pedestrians up? Because that's going to be a lot cheaper. It's going to be a lot lighter.
I think that you want to keep the bikes and peds down low, but you also want to humanize that street. If there's an option to elevate the road and move the traffic fast and get out west, then why don't we turn that bottom street into something usable for everybody? And so, because it's almost like if you go back to alternative 2, it's like, okay, well, here we're trying to humanize it on the outside edges and then move traffic through in the middle, right? And then, but what we do with design 3 you get the ultimate moving traffic. You know, you have limited access, you're pretty much on a highway, design speed's probably 70, so you're moving people through. So down there, it seems like, well, that's where you slow down. You have the best facilities you can have for bikes and peds, and then you start relating it to the surroundings. And it seems like we could kind of take that bottom part and get like a win-win out of that. It's like there's a lot of potential for that. The room that we have.
Let's go to the one other thing, which was you showed a map that had bicycle facilities off at a distance someplace. That one.
Well,
I can't come to grips with that particular part of the road. You get the bicycles off of the main area and you move it away, and that's kind of what I was thinking. If you had an elevated bicycle facility, it's going to cost a fraction of the cars. You don't have to have the weight of a car. And over the size.
You might do that with an elevated bicycle facility, but if you do that, a lot of this distance on Southern, once you get out west anyway, remember there's a canal on the south side. So you only have commercial development or something that you'd want to access on the north side of the roadway. And if you put the bikes up, then where's the utility accessing? For accessing any shops or businesses or...
Well, I was trying to come to grips with Heather's thinking about if what you're intending to do is isolate the car, the traffic. Even on the road with the frontage roads,
mm-hmm.
that makes it, you're using a lot of space.
On which concept?
A lot of right away.
On the first
concept, really. No, second concept.
It's a lot. Yeah, 110 feet is a lot.
No, and adding 90 feet of right away is going to be hideously expensive.
My sense is we don't want to add right away. We want to figure out, and what we want to do is get something that long term we're going to be there for a long time. Beyond the first iteration, the next one, what's that one going to be, and what are you creating here for the long term?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. In the long term, kind of going back with Sally. Where are those destinations along the highway? And, you know, from a bike ped standpoint, would they want to be up high to reach those destinations, or would they want to be dead low?
I think you really like them all the same. You were commenting, you'd be better off if they were all on the same level.
The destinations and the bike peds?
Yeah. But the thing is, people are not going to walk very far.
Exactly. So the cars will go 10, 20 miles, no problem, but yet with your bikes, it's 2 miles, and if your ped, it's a quarter mile. So those destination points are closer to them. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, can I ask Valerie to provide a suggestion or question?
Well, looking at this graphic and going to your point, Heather, about having the pedestrian and bicycles below, I wonder, like when I see this, I envision like the underline, so maybe there could be, with that extra space underneath, that that's what it is, just like green space, and then there could be a multi-use path down the middle, and then they'd have shade. So,
activated
and lighted underneath, it's just another mm-hmm. option versus up above, because that's one thing people complain about is shade, too.
I knew this graphic would inspire that concept. What I want to point out is that at each one of these yellow dots, there will be left turns under the bridge to allow people who are traveling east on the frontage road to go north onto those cross streets, or west on the frontage road to go south onto those cross streets. So there will be interactions that make it complex to provide any sort of continuous facility under the bridge or elevated roadway. Not that it can't be done, but that it will be complex.
I would suggest perhaps a separated cycle track on both sides, since they're anticipating purchasing right away or fitting it in here, go for a premium bike facility that's separated from the road, cycle track on both sides. There's far distances between these interchanges, so not a lot of interruptions, so it would be an ideal location.
I absolutely agree. If we're going to have a top-notch highway, we should have a top-notch bicycle system as well.
Absolutely.
Okay. Going to cover the western section as well, from US 27 over to 20 Mile Bend. First, I want to point out that there are alternatives being identified, including continuous protected bicycle facility on the State Road 80 corridor from US 27 all the way up to the point here near the Lakeside Medical Center where the corridor turns east. There is an alternative freight route already identified on Hooker Highway that comes down State Road 715. And I want to mention in passing, just so this committee is aware, that the MPO board last, where are we now? In July, yeah, we're all the way to September. In July, the MPO board adopted its priority list and actually chose to add the construction of a US 27 connector road, which would pass from 715 and Hooker Highway, this intersection right here. It would travel west and then south, all the way down to US 27 and South Bay as a third option, north-south. So you've got 715, you've got State Road 80. This connector road would provide access to this large parcel right here, which is the 850-acre Intermodal Logistics Center. So that's now become an MPO priority, and they're going to be looking to the together with the DOT and the county to identify an alignment for that corridor and provide truck and shipping access as well as employment access to this Intermodal Logistics Center right here. The Main Street treatments in the downtown of Belgrade, and then head bike crossing improvements to improve safety for pedestrians as well as cyclists going east to west across the corridor. There are considerations of transit system improvements or transit service improvements throughout the communities. And then mentioned the roadway rehab to the east is County Road 880 construction. And then the transit hub in the downtown or the center of Belgrade here. And then in the more rural portion, is the MPO through its regional greenways master plan has identified this corridor as a potential location for a corridor-wide greenway, as well as a resurfacing project that's underway or going to be underway next year from the railroad tracks all the way to 20 Mile Bend here at County Road 880, with the potential consideration to introduce street lighting, continuous street lighting in the corridor, not as part of the resurfacing project, but potentially in the years following the resurfacing. So that's going to be studied for incorporation as well. And the county's doing a continuous rehabilitation and maintenance on County Road 880. And then the DOT is also constructing shoulder stabilization to improve safety on the State Road 80 corridor. So next steps, that's the alternatives that are being looked at and considered for the West piece. Next steps, we're in the midst of this finalization of Tier 2 evaluations and doing an alternatives public workshop. And then the consultant team, together with the DOT project management, is going to be preparing the final report and completing the study in early 2018. I think that wraps up the presentation, if anybody has any follow-up questions.
I just have one, which is the location. You said that the MPO voted to add an additional north-south corridor. West, is this basically something that's improved, like where 98 goes around the lake? Is that what that is, or a completely separate facility?
This is the edge of Lake Okeechobee.
Mm-hmm.
And the corridor would go from, right now, if you ever drive Hooker Highway, I think my battery just died. I'm using the laser too much. If you ever drive west on Hooker Highway, it dead ends at 715. The corridor that the MPO added to its priority list is an extension of that of Hooker Highway west of 715, but it would turn south before you get to Lake Okeechobee and connect to US 27 in South Bay.
Okay.
So it really provides access to the access to the Intermodal Logistics Center and another truck route available for trucks passing from the 27th corridor, yeah, that don't want to travel through 715 or on State Road 80 through Beltway.
At the beginning of the presentation, you in the backup items, they were talk about the unfunded needs managed lanes. Is there going to be tolls along?
That's a good question for you to ask next month when the team is here.
Okay.
It's my understanding that the answer is no, but I'm not certain that that's the right answer. So I have that question as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see. All right. Well, thanks for letting me introduce it.
Thank you.
Bob?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, the set that there are no, we don't have anything planned for bicycle facilities to get out of along 710. We didn't get that, did we?
Correct.
So there's no way to get there's no bicycle way to get out there today.
Well, 710 doesn't come to this part of Palm Beach County.
Yeah.
It goes a little bit further north and west.
Yeah. But there is one along, well, 441, that's essentially, which is over our way.
441 goes, its alignment goes here, and then it turns north at this point and goes north into Pahokee. So this is 441. This is 715.
Yeah, okay. I get that. And it becomes 80s. Is it 80? 80 out there.
Well, 80, yeah, so 80 comes this way, east-west, and then the alignment turns south, and it's Main Street through Beltway, and it curls to the west again, hits 20-mile bend, here's Belgrade High School, they've got an access point right here, and then 80 comes back and hits US 27 in South Bay, and then the 80 alignment continues north and west through South Bay and over around the lake into Clewiston.
Okay, I think I understand that. Between you and the...
Yeah. Sure. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. We'll move along to item number C. It's a motion of recommended alternatives for the I-95 Southern Boulevard SR-80 interchange from FDOT, Casey, and Humberto. I'm with the firm of RSNH. I'm here with Humberto Arrieta. He is the new project manager for this project. Previously, it was Anson Sonnet. You may have remembered him. They kind of switched projects. They traded projects. But Anson is still involved, in case you're all wondering. He's just not able to be here today. So we're going to give you a real quick update on this project and where we're at. It is the I-95 at State Road 80 PD&E study for the interchange improvements. This project is one that came out of the I-95 Interchange Master Plan study that was an SIS study that identified short and long-term improvements as well as other interchange projects and PD&E studies in the county. Just so you, just for a recap, this is our study area from Australian Congress Avenue on the west side of the interchange to Parker Avenue on the east side of the interchange, and then on I-95 from about 1,000 feet both south and north of the interchange ramps. The purpose and need of the study was established during the ETDM process, or the Efficient Transportation Decision-Making process, and that was established by or with input from all of the agencies, the permitting agencies, and also it was refined during the course of this study. Basically, the purpose and need of this study is to increase the overall efficiency and operational efficiency of the interchange and improve the capacity and meet the future traffic demand. A lot of you may ask, well, where's that future traffic demand coming from? Well, it's coming from a lot of the anticipated growth in the western parts of the county. Nick spoke a little bit about that in his update on the State Road 80 Action Plan team. There's expected to be an additional 30,000 trips using the State Road 80 corridor. Many of them are going to the interchange on the eastern end of the State Road 80 corridor.
So two of the studies that we are working very closely with to make sure that our what we are planning doesn't preclude anything they're planning and that everything is consistent and compliant. We're working with the Steroid 80 Action Plan team, and we're also working with the I-95 Managed Lanes team. We've given both of them our design files, and we've swapped ideas. I was just made aware today that by Nick that if alternative 2 or 3 of the action plan team moves forward, it may change our design a little bit, but that's okay because we have been in coordination with them, and we've already put some plans in motion to accommodate that. The important thing to note here is that in 2015, this northbound I-95 to westbound State Road 80 movement was already failing, and the eastbound State Road 80 to northbound I-95 movement was close to failing. As we move into the design year of 2040, which is what we design our projects to, because we have to look into the future to see what may happen. You can see here that three of the four movements are failing. The fourth movement up there is still very, very close to failing, but not quite. So during the course of this study, we took a look at four different alternatives. Number two was eliminated. It provided a third and fourth level flyover. That was eliminated due to public opinion and the amount of right-of-way that it required from the Dreher Park. So we took a look at all the alternatives from both a qualitative standpoint and a quantitative standpoint, and these are all the criteria that we compared them to here. And that what it brought us down to is that alternative 4 had the most benefits out of all the alternatives. Now, some of the greatest impacts of this alternative are, number one, the total amount of right-of-way required, which is 1.5 acres, and also the visual effects, or the aesthetic effects on the communities. So alternative 4, which is our recommended alternative, provides a northbound I-95 to westbound State Road 80 flyover, as well as an eastbound State Road 80 to northbound I-95 flyover. Now, they are both at the third level. It's not a third and a fourth level. So right now, State Road 80, it goes over I-95. That is considered a second level overpass. So this would be one level higher. Okay, there is some right-of-way acquisition proposed, but only on the west side of I-95. So on the south side of State Road 80, as it stands designed today, we would have to acquire 12 to 28 feet between Lang Road and Gem Lake Road, only on the south side of State Road 80. Between Lang Road and I-95, there would be a very small sliver of right-of-way of up to 7 feet acquired. But there would be no relocations. On the north side of State Road 80, between I-95 and Gem Lake Drive, we would need to acquire between 0 and 56 feet in order for this interchange alternative to work. Now, the typical section, what we did to try to address some of the visual aesthetic impacts of this alternative is we moved the roadway a little bit over towards the north side of the right-of-way to create this 3-foot landscape buffer that will be on the south side of the MSE wall. And that's to create just a little bit, you know, a little bit more green space for the residents that are on the south side in the town of Cloud Lake and Glen Ridge. Now, on the east side of I-95, there will be no right-of-way acquisition, and this will be the typical section. What we did was we were required to close this meeting opening here at Paseo Alcala. There is an existing median opening that allows eastbound cars to turn left into the Vedado neighborhood. We met with our access management committee, and they recommended that location be closed. What that did allow us to do, though, was it allowed us to lengthen this storage lane here for Parker Avenue, and it also allowed us to improve this storage bay for the Dreher Park Zoo. If you know this area at all, that left-turn storage lane into the Dreher Park property is extremely substandard. It fits like maybe two cars, and the taper is pretty much non-existent. So it did allow us to give a standard turn lane and taper at that location. Oh, and also, one thing that we just did very recently was we met with the city and we decreased the width of these lanes. They used to be 2 12-foot lanes with a 4-foot bike lane. We decreased the width of the travel lanes to 2 11-foot lanes so we could get a 6-foot bike lane in that area. Again, we are not acquiring right-of-way in this area, even though you see that the roadway is to be widened. There is excess right-of-way on the south side of the road, and that's where we're putting in this, we're proposing that exclusive right turn lane onto Parker Avenue. Now, on Parker Avenue, all improvements will be made within the existing right-of-way. There will be sheros provided on the roadway. Currently, we are still working with the city on the typical section of this roadway. They've recently changed some things, and so we're still in the process. So this may not be what you see when we go to public hearing next month. So some other improvements that are going to be happening are the bridges over I-95 and the railroad will be widened slightly. There will be increased storage at all the off-ramps and on-ramps, exit ramps and turn lanes. The bike facilities will be upgraded throughout the corridor. On the west side of I-95, where the roadway is going to be reconstructed, we are proposing 7-foot buffered bike lanes and green pavement in the areas of where it's appropriate, like in the keyhole lanes and things like that. We're going to have upgraded pedestrian facilities and crosswalks throughout. This is a rendering, and now some of the visual impacts that we know that we're going to have, we have created some renderings to help people better visualize those impacts and what this alternative may look like. This is a rendering that is taken from the west side of the corridor, starting like say Australian Congress is over here, and you're looking east towards 95. What this shows is this is the northbound I-95 to westbound ramp descending into the median of State Road 80, and then this is the eastbound State Road 80. It's northbound I-95 ramp that comes under, braids under the ramp, and then after Gem Lake, it goes up and stuck at the third level, and they both peel off like that. Okay. This is a rendering of what it might look like driving east on State Road 80, approaching I-95. And here's that landscape buffer that I told you about. Oh, and you can see the green pavement. This is what it might look like if you're driving out of Lang Road, approaching State Road 80. As you can see, the county building in the background there. I think actually that's the hotel, and the county building is over there. And then this is a view that we created specifically for the residents of the town of Cloud Lake and Glen Ridge. They have that sign there in the southwest quadrant of the interchange. We wanted to show them that their billboard is not totally blocked from the old buildings. And this is a view that from Oak Street in the Vidado neighborhood. This is Oak Street here and Parkland Road that runs directly adjacent and parallel to the existing on-ramp, northbound on-ramp at I-95. And this view, we created this view based on the concerns of the residents of Vidado. They said, what are we going to see? Are we going to see this big, huge, monstrous overpass over our neighborhood? And so we did a rendering. This is based on a true photo taken at this location. As a matter of fact, we had a meeting at this guy's house right here. And so we took a photo, and then based on all of these, I should have told you, all of these renderings are based on actual horizontal and vertical geometry. So they're to scale exactly, you know, what the geometry is. So as you can see, it might be hard to see, but I do have them here if you want to take a look afterwards. That lighter gray wall, that is the existing noise wall on the I-95 northbound ramp. And that dark gray shadow above it, that is the proposed third level overpass. So as you can see, you can't see a whole lot. They won't be able to see cars on that on the flyover, but they will probably be able to see trucks. And that is one thing that we may add for the public hearing is put a truck up there just to see if we can see it. Okay, and as you can see, on the other side of I-95, you can see the Hilton Hotel tower up there that they can see today. And then this is another rendering that we did for the Vidado residents because, again, they were concerned about the proximity of the proposed flyover to their neighborhood. This is northbound I-95, so you're looking north, and this is the eastbound and northbound flyover coming in, and then it connects to the existing northbound I-95 ramp. So as you can see, it's already starting to descend as it approaches the I-95 existing ramp. So it's not going to be that much higher on this side, on the east side of I-95. So the next steps that for us are we are going to our public hearing in October, on October 19th next month. After that, we will be finalizing our alternatives, incorporating any public comments. There is a public involvement section of our reports that we have to incorporate all the comments that we receive. And we'll be tweaking our plans, incorporating whatever improvements we can. We still have some meetings to attend with the cities. And we'll be submitting all of our final engineering documents in December of 2017. And hopefully by March of 2018, we will have our location design concept acceptance. If you have any questions or need any more information, you can contact Umberto at this address and telephone number and email address here. We also have everything posted on our website. Everything is pretty much up to date. Prior to the public hearing, we will be displaying our documents at three different locations. One will be the library on Summit Boulevard. We'll be displaying them at the Vidado Community Center, as well as the town of Glen Ridge. So those will be on display by September 28th. And they will be on display through October 30th. But all of those documents will also be placed on our website. So you don't have to go anywhere. You can just pop on the website and see them. Okay, that's it. Thank you. Any questions?
I'll leave questions to the committee members. I did just want to say that I know a lot of times with these projects, it's hard to visualize, so I appreciate having the rendering. I think that helps with getting a sense of... project.
Yeah, it's hard to convey that to the public, and that's exactly why we did this. You know, because they don't understand profiles and
right.
So was all this in the information in our packet, or is
this is probably a little bit different than what was distributed prior to the meeting? I did change two slides.
Okay, and this will be included on the website. We'll update the website with this presentation.
No.
Thank you. Good job. Thank you.
Thank you
for the visualization. I do have a few questions.
Okay.
I know that you're working with the city, so the city of West Palm Beach, so thank you. One of my questions was, is there landscape included in this budget?
Typically, the DOT does not provide landscaping in a PDE study.
Mm-hmm.
They used to, then they took it out. Now we're starting to get it back incorporated.
Okay.
We are putting in a landscaping commitment into our PD&E document that there will be either a separate landscaping project or the landscaping will be included with the final design project.
And has it been looked at by the landscape architect to see if the 3 foot was sufficient for
yes.
plantings that were
yes, we
shown?
We had to coordinate that with the DOT's landscape architect and also their maintenance department.
Okay. That's a very narrow space.
Correct.
Between two big concrete footers, probably.
Yes, and so they told us, they gave us some suggested plants to put in there that would grow, right, that would grow very narrowly, that would require very little maintenance. We actually first thought of like a living wall,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you have the vines on it and everything. They, at that time, they didn't like that option. There's no real standard for the treatment as of yet, but that's not to say that it can't be an option in the future. Because I know they do use it in some areas of Florida. It's just that the DOT has not yet adopted it, so
okay.
it's still not off the table.
So there's a commitment for the landscape in the PD&E?
In the PD&E document, yes.
And then, thank you. My other question is, have you looked at... Okay, part of the city of West Palm Beach, but bicycle master plan, I know that you've discussed with the city, is with Parker, making Parker a main north-south connection. But also, one of the things that were discussed, and I don't know if this was there before, was Dryer Park, and that kind of where you're doing that improved turn lanes there, that would also be a great location for a cross for people. That's the entrance to the park, and that would be a great location for people to get in and out right there as well. So if that intersection could somehow include some sort of pedestrian crossing, that would be fantastic for people accessing. That's a main destination point to the park, and then also a multi-use trail that's proposed within the park.
Right, right. We did discuss that proposed trail that goes from Palm Beach Atlantic down the east side of I-95 and crossing over to go to Dreher, and they were suggesting a let's see if I have the rendering. They were, let me go back to the slide. They were suggesting a full median opening at the Dreher Park. We took a look at, they were requesting a full median opening here with a Sigma. We took a look at what would be required for that, just based on a vehicle count basis, and it would require 105 vehicles per hour on the side street that would be approaching that in order to warrant a signal at that location. So we did respond to the city, letting them know that, but there's other things that could be put there. We did suggest a pedestrian actuated signal that might be an option, you know, with a high emphasis crosswalk, or, you know, even a pedestrian overpass. I mean, all of those are ideas that could be evaluated. But those are typically final design details. We don't actually explore those in the PD&E phase unless it's something that is a commitment that we have to make.
Do you think that design makes it more prohibitive or makes it easier for bikes and pets to cross at that location?
This design?
Yes.
Well, actually, this design at least would provide a pedestrian refuge in the middle. But a full median, a full intersection would also provide that refuge as well.
But there's no slowing down, it's just the turning movements now, right?
Correct. But I'm saying if it was a signalized. Okay. If there was a pedestrian signal or a full signal. I mean, I don't believe that the department would opt for a full signal opening at that location, but certainly a pedestrian signal would be able to be looked at.
Because the measurement is cars, correct?
But not just cars, but that is the major controlling factor.
Okay, so the major controlling factor is cars in order to get something for bikes and pets. So I guess maybe it'd be beneficial if DOT could look at it from the point of bikes and pets, because that is a main bike and ped crossing of a neighborhood up to the north to a large park to the south.
Right. And we can work with the city in that capacity during final design and figure out if something needs to be done at that location.
I do have another couple more questions. Does anybody else have questions?
No. Okay.
And then where are the 1.4 acres that are being acquired?
That's all on the west side of I-95.
Okay.
Mostly from the county property.
Yeah. And the other one, okay. And then can we look at this section again one more time? That's a lot to take in a good amount of time. Okay.
Yeah. That's why this is not as powerful as the rendering. I've gotten that comment from a lot of people that this is just a little too much to understand. So it is easier when you look at, you know, this rendering here. That typical section is like, say you're cutting it right here. You're taking a snapshot right across the roadway here.
So a 6-foot sidewalk, a 7-foot bike lane, and a 6-foot sidewalk. And that vary right-of-way acquisition depends on the existing right-of-way.
Well, just because you've got no turn, you're up on MSE wall here, and then you're coming down on the MSE wall, and then you've got this turn lane coming out here. So you're expanding to get in your, so you've got your 7-foot bike lane, you come in here, and then as you're expanding into this taper area, that's where the variation is coming in.
I know you work with the city. The city's still working with you on things.
Yes.
So we're not endorsing it at this time, but I understand that you're definitely trying your best to work with them. So thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate your comments.
I have a question. On this slide, it looks like that bike lane on the south
mm-hmm.
side
yeah.
is in the middle of 60 feet of pavement, 5-lane traffic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It seems dangerous to me.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to physically separate that lane? Like, not just put stripes down, but like have a physical barrier? Because it looks dangerous. How fast are the people going on this?
That's
stretch?
A 45-mile-an-hour design speed.
45?
Sorry. I believe, yeah, 45.
45.
That's
so you're in the middle of potentially 55-mile-an-hour traffic. Mm-hmm. With 60 feet of pavement.
Well, hopefully the people in the turn lanes are slowing down. But no, I understand.
They get 12 feet each. You know, every
right.
other lane gets 12 feet, and the bike
right.
gets 7 in the middle.
The separated bike lanes, most of you know that the Florida Design Manual has just come out.
Mm-hmm.
There is a chapter on, there's a new chapter on bike lanes,
mm-hmm.
and there is a reference to the FHWA guidelines for physically separated bike lanes. Those were not incorporated into this study because this study started way before that. So that is one thing that will have to be done during the reevaluation and the design phase. Off the top of my head, I have not reviewed the FHWA guidelines, so I don't know if there's any more physical space that would be needed in order to provide the separation, because that would mean more right-of-way to be acquired. So that I'm not sure of right now. And I would think that if you're putting, you know, the bike lane between, yeah, so. It's always a trade-off. Do you want, you know.
Is that 6 feet on the left-hand side? Is that
yes.
on the
sidewalk?
Oh, that's sidewalk.
Yes.
Well, that's scary, too. Well, yeah, I mean, it seems like you could kind of, even if for the 7 foot on the side where it's between the turn lanes and the through traffic, you could move it over with the sidewalks. And then it's almost like bike lanes have turned into wiggle room for cars. And so it's like, oh, well, we need to actually just go off to the side for a little bit. So it seems like it could be integrated into the sidewalks on both sides and then be protected by a curb at some point instead of being right there. And I'll defer to Bob because he is our
I'm trying to visualize this. And I'm not up to where you are yet. But I think you're hearing that as they just go eastbound, those two far right turn lanes.
That's for the southbound.
That goes on the side on 95.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to start off down here in the bottom of that. You're going to have to shift over two lanes just to get into that slot, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, basically, it's the cars that would have having to shift. Well, the bikes will have to shift one lane. The cars will have to shift. Because here's the
yes.
shift right here.
Yes.
So just east of Lane Road, the bikes would shift to the green pavement here, and the cars would shift. Yeah, so there's always a shift when bikes
let me tell you
cars
something.
Go into turn lanes.
When in that situation, the bicyclist shifts because he defers to the cars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you've got two lanes cutting across there. Now, the green cars can help a lot.
Well, do you think the bicyclist would stay in that lane and feel safe, or do you think the bicyclist would go onto the sidewalk at that point?
At that point in time, the cars are going by at 50, they'll be going 60 miles an hour, right?
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I hear your concern, and because, I mean, I'm an avid bike rider. I don't ride fast. You know, I've got my beach cruiser, and a lot of times I avoid the bike lanes because of instances like this. But if we were to combine them, and I love shared use paths,
yeah.
but even if we were to put the bikes and peds together on a shared use path, according to state regulations, we still have to provide bike lanes on the road
mm-hmm.
because they're vehicles.
Yeah.
then we increase.
So,
and that's why
and then we increase.
Yes.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, at some point.
I've already tried that argument
There should be a threshold. If you max out like a certain, you know, if you have a 12-foot, you know, shared use path, then there's sufficient room for, you know, for both bikes and pets, and then that could, especially in certain circumstances where you have 60-foot traffic going by beside you on both ways, that it could say that in this condition, this is better.
Right. Well, one thing I should mention with the new FDM, we may be able to go to 11-foot lanes instead of 12-foot lanes and get a bigger. But the bike lanes will be able to be in greater than 7 feet, but it might provide, there could be some physical separation. Again, that's a final design.
Is that a minimum detail. 7 feet now?
No, it's a maximum.
So, I mean, you could do a minimum bike lane, but then increase the sidewalk, and then you could, wait, if you got to go down to 11-foot lanes, you could do, FDOT, that's your standard, here you go, we're providing a minimum, but we're providing a larger sidewalk where people could actually use it for both bikes and pedestrians.
But then we would have to increase the sidewalk by 6 feet.
Well, if you get 5 lanes, you've got five feet in there. Mm-hmm. Plus, if whatever the minimum is for a bike, then you get a couple more feet there. So that's 5.
Well, there's different rules. If you're rebuilding the road, if you're reconstructing the road,
uh-huh.
you have to have the 7 foot. It goes in. There's certain criteria.
Oh, so that's
if, if you're resurfacing the road, you can still get away with a minimum 4 foot bike lane.
Okay.
But if you're rebuilding the road, and we are acquiring right away, we're going to to do the standard bike lane, which is now 7 feet.
Okay, that's a standard. Okay, misunderstood. Thank you.
So how do the pedestrians get across?
There's going to be signalized crosswalks.
But not from the north side of the south side of the street, right?
No. Through an interchange, you don't provide north and south or across the main line. It'll just be east and west connectivity for the pedestrians. Over I-95, right? But there will be pedestrian refuges because the turn lanes onto the entrance ramps and the turn lanes off the exit ramps, they will be signalized. So pedestrians will have a pedestrian island, and then they will be signalized and they'll cross over to the main.
There will be a traffic light to stop the cars, or there'll be a spot where the pedestrian sits there and waits until it's a spot that they can walk across, but it's only like a 10-foot span, right? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, all the ramp movements are going to be signalized.
So,
right. So
up there,
say for instance, these two right turns going on to southbound I-95,
yeah.
They're going to be signalized.
Okay.
So when they're stopped, the pedestrian can go across.
Okay.
To the other side of the bridge and continue on the bridge.
Thank you. Does anyone have any more questions?
Yes. On the west side, you had a signal there. How does that mesh with the other proposal for the corridor? So one was sort of a freeway option, but then you come into 95 area, and then you suddenly stop after you've been on.
Right, and you're talking about this signal here at Gem Lake. I was talking to Nick about that right before before the meeting got started, and we've already started discussing some other changes. If we wanted to get rid of that, there are some other changes that would be necessary, and what it would entail, or one of the options that it would entail, one of the things we thought of, because this is way outside of the scope of this project. But one of the ideas is that you remove, because currently, right now, there is a westbound State Road 80 to southbound Congress movement, which is this one right here that's shown. Okay, this one that comes here, and then it goes up on the existing overpass and goes south onto Congress. Okay? Now, I'm aware that the county wants to change that eastbound State Road 80 to northbound Congress into a 3-lane left turn. Okay? But they can't because there's not the physical separation with this left turn coming in. So as you're turning your left turns, there's just not that separation. But if you eliminate this movement, you can get that eastbound to northbound left turn movement from Southern to Congress. Now, this movement here would have to be displaced to Gem Lake Drive. This Gem Lake Drive right now doesn't go through. It goes into the county property and just goes into a parking lot. However, it could be punched through to Australian Avenue. I don't know if we could pull up Google Maps, I could show you. It could be just turned right, and then it just would tee into Australian Avenue right by the airport, and then you create an intersection there, and that would handle that movement. So, and then that would allow at least this express lane, this ramp movement, to go over this one, because this one could be, because right now we're constrained right here. We have to be at the second level in order to get these two movements underneath here. If we could start bringing this ramp down sooner, you know, because we would eliminate those two, we could bring this one over this one and it wouldn't have to stop. But that would only be for the ramps. Now, if you want to eliminate the whole intersection, the lights, you know, Nick suggested, well, eliminate that light and punch through to Congress Avenue. Make them go that way and access. You might make Glenridge and Cloud Lake go to Congress Avenue. So, but that's much bigger than what.
But you have to consider that because of the corridor study, right? To connect, the two.
If that's
two-way option.
If the corridor study is going to be deciding on option two or option three, then we're going to have to reevaluate that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And probably some other options as well.
Between now and the public hearing at some point in the future?
No, that would have to be at some point in the future.
So that's not a reevaluation. That's a we thought about it, but we didn't
include
it.
No, that would be a reevaluation. Because, again, some event happened that changed the scope of this project. So now this concept has to be reevaluated. So items can change in this concept. This is just one idea that works. You know, we did look at other interchange configurations, but this is the one that works the best right now under existing conditions. But if something happens on, say, the State Road 80 Action Plan, if a decision is made, and it changes how this one operates, well, then we have to reevaluate how that's going to affect our operations, and it may affect our concept, and then that's a reevaluation.
So what, I mean, you know that both are happening. What's that contingency plan, and what's the timeline for that look like?
Well, they are in the planning stage.
Uh-huh.
Their project is going to now be spawning PD&E projects and PD&E studies, much like this
December,
is a PD&E
right,
study.
In December, but you're going to public hearing in October, correct?
Well, we're going to public hearing in October, and once we get our approval on our document, that signifies the end of our PD&E phase.
Mm-hmm.
So then our project can move into final design. Okay, our final design is not funded till 2021. Okay, so but during that time period, if these studies come along, or we know that that's out there now, we can be reevaluating these options and say, okay, well, now we need the design to change. And it doesn't mean we have to go back to square one and start a PD&E study all over again, because that's a long process. In order to get the project programmed, that's probably 5 years, then to get the project funded, then to get the project, you know, through the NEPA process, okay, it's going to take that would be at least, you know, 2 to 3 years to go through the whole NEPA process again, then to get the project funded for design. So the key is to keep the project moving, and if the design changes, you reevaluate, but in the meantime, you're marching through the process. The process is flexible. It allows for changes in the design, but the PD&E process is very long. But as long as we keep the overall process going, we're good.
Okay.
Is there like a threshold of change? Like okay, I'm in planning and zoning, so you know, with non-conforming buildings is my, you know, the relationship of that. But is there a threshold? Like if the design changes this much, then we have to it triggers something else, or you know, something like that.
Well, this goes back to the level of original documentation.
Okay.
Right now, this document under NEPA guidelines is a categorical exclusion. Okay. Which means that there are no significant impacts to resources, to human resources, environmental, socioeconomic, right away. Okay, you have to remember, it's an objective point of view, you know, and it's kind of like art. It's not in the eye of the beholder. What is significant to some person may not be to the other. And it's always going to be that way. So anyways, what has been decided right now is that this is a categorical exclusion based on the impacts. If the design were to change to, say, for instance, we wipe out the Vedado area, that's a significant change. That would probably not be allowed under a reevaluation because that change is so significant and so impactful that it would say, you know what, it can't be covered under that categorical exclusion. That would be kicked up to what they call an EA FONSI, or an environmental assessment, or even, because it's a historic neighborhood, that might be going up to an environmental impact statement. So there would be a lot of factors that you'd have to take into account before that determination could be made.
But I guess kind of going back into what we were saying, in concept 2 and 3, you don't think that would trigger... You know, I mean, 2 or 3 was chosen for the corridor study. You don't think that would trigger moving backwards? It would just be a reevaluation.
It would just be a reevaluation, right? Right.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So I guess she was looking for a consensus recommendation for endorsement. I guess all in favor to endorse can say aye, and all not can say nay. Okay, all in favor to endorse? Say aye. Sally? Everyone? Bob?
It's an awful lot. Sorry. I don't see anything that's jumping out at me wrong.
Okay, so they were endorsed. Alex?
Madam Chair, let me just interject.
Yeah, thank you.
You don't have two options.
Okay.
You can endorse, you can endorse with requested modifications.
Okay.
Or you can say, we just don't like what we see and we don't think this should be endorsed at all. Even if it were modified, we don't want this project to move forward. I think those are the options available to the MPO Governing Board.
Okay.
And those are the options that we're asking you to give input to their consideration.
Okay, so I guess since we're in consensus version, I'm a little concerned. I'm not sure exactly how to do the... Just do the same thing, but
you still have motions and votes.
Motions and votes.
They don't get recorded as formal actions of the committee because you don't have a full quorum.
Okay. So there you go. So thank you. So a recommendation to endorse, a recommendation to endorse with modifications, or recommendations for not endorsement. Would anyone like to make that recommendation to start with, and then we can vote on it afterwards?
Let me ask another question. There's going to be some meetings with the public, and the results of those meetings will get fed back into the process again. Is there a spot where if we don't endorse now, can we come back and endorse later?
No.
Goes to the
board.
It goes to the board.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought you were talking about the public hearing.
The public hearing will occur.
Correct.
And the public hearing results will be fed to the board, and the board will make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Let me clarify that. that's that's in reverse.
Right.
It's in reverse. This goes to the MPO governing board for an endorsement or requested modifications or rejection prior to the public hearing.
Okay.
The public hearing is a required event that the department's consultant team must perform in order to give anyone from the public their last opportunity to provide input on this recommended alternative.
Now I understand. I understand.
So in the absence of requested changes or objections to this project, the department will go into the public hearing with this recommended alternative. They'll ask, does anyone have any input? They'll think about that input that they get, and then they will get now central office of the DOT, not the Federal Highway Administration any longer, to approve their concept, their recommended alternative, and say, yep, that's the approved concept for this location. Go ahead and move into design.
Right, but that's not to say that there aren't design changes that can be made at that point. There always will be design changes. This is, you know, that's one thing that everybody has a very difficult time comprehending, is that this is a concept. It is one idea that works with the projected traffic. It may not be the only idea. We have looked at a lot of different interchange options, but This may change based on State Road 80 Action Plan team. And from what I hear today, it's most likely going to change. So it may not be the final option that you see or that you endorse. When it goes to design, there will be changes. What those changes are, we don't know. But there's always changes when it goes to design. Yes.
It seems to me that, I mean, the design they have addresses the issue with the traffic, kind of minimizing the impacts on those immediately affected neighborhoods. And the thing, as far as bicycle and pedestrian, would be, I mean, the ideal thing would be to be able to narrow those lanes down to 11 feet, so we've got an extra 5 feet to play with in terms of the multi-use path or a more sheltered bike lane. And I mean, I would move that that be our suggestion. This alternative looks like a reasonable alternative for dealing with the traffic, but we'd want to see them take that, narrow those lanes down so we have an extra 5 feet basically to attribute to the bicycle and pedestrian alternatives here, whether it's a larger, lane divided, multi-use path that's going to be able to get across the I-95 itself with signals, or whether it's a more buffered, bicycle lane, going down the center, then that's what I'd like to see. But I think that this alternative that requires very little right-of-way, and I'm familiar with that area, this right-of-way where they're talking about taking right-of-way is not a big impact on any sort of neighborhood.
And one thing I should mention that I forgot to mention is that in PD&E, we design basically two standards. We don't design for instances where if a right-of-way acquisition is going to cause severe hardship on a person or a property. We design to standards. We design to what we used to call the Cadillac. Now we probably should call it a Maserati or something. but in design, they can take that and they go, oh, you know what? This, we really don't need all that space. We can get a design variation for that element, meaning we can squeeze it down to the bare minimum and still make it safe. But we can't do that in PD&E. So that's why I'm saying in design, there's always going to be changes. And so we may be able to increase the sidewalk width. We may be able to increase, or get a shared use path. But right now, if we were to do that, it would show, much more severe right-of-way impact. So there's always going to be some changes. They can minimize things even a little bit more in design, but in PD&E we're held to to the standards.
I think
and worst case, and we always have to show the worst case impacts. Mm-hmm. It's always better when you're at this stage to show the worst case impacts, and then you can back off and minimize a little bit more from there. Okay, but right now, you know, at this stage in the process, it's better if we just say this is the worst that the impacts would be, just so everybody knows. But you know, hopefully they will be able to be minimized even more. Yeah, you know, because we've done our best to minimize the impacts, but in final design, they'll probably be able to minimize them even more.
I think Sally was recommending endorsement with modifications to look at better protected bike lanes. Is that correct?
Yeah, that would be a preference, but it's like she says, what we're really looking at, I mean, they could have proposed something that takes more right-of-way. There's no way you'd get a CE if you did that, because if they take anything out of it, the environmental impact asks you, you know, are you having impact on wetlands? Are you having impacts on neighborhoods? Are you having impacts on historic things of historic significance, on endangered species, et cetera, a bunch of things which, I mean, forget it, it's already wiped out here anyway, so they can check off no. If they go through with a different alternative that takes more right of way east of I-95, mm-hmm. they're not going to be able to do that. They're going to have to deal with the historic impacts with the
Forum.
That includes visual
right.
impacts for the neighborhood.
Right. And you talked about possibly doing lane narrowing in order to...
Yeah, I think that...
So you're suggesting looking at it, endorsing, but... Maybe
endorsing, and when they go into the design phase, I mean, that would be our recommendation, I would think, mm-hmm. that you minimize the lanes, you take that footage and put it into a better bicycle pedestrian alternative than you have with this standard, but what they're providing, you know, with this particular, you know, configuration of the overpass and this particular amount of right-of-way, to me looks like a good solution.
Absolutely.
You know,
after thinking about it, I would recommend that mm-hmm. we would endorse
mm-hmm.
this plan.
Mm-hmm.
I think all the elements are there that need to be there, and this, we got 7 foot, you know, we got buffer bike lanes, and that's a lot better than we've ever had in a long time. But the one thing is, if we were to recommend that they narrow lanes, and the thing that would help me is if we narrow a lane, would that result in slower speeds? And I don't even think they. I don't think they even know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying I don't know that we really want to recommend that we narrow the lanes to make it low, because I would want to get the speed low somehow or other slow down.
Okay.
That would be my concern, is that the car's going by at high speeds. But
so it's
going to be signalized in this situation when you get to the intersection.
Well, right? Correct. Because as you come up to the actual interchange itself, if you're not in these elevated lanes, the interchanges are going to be signalized, the interchange
yeah.
ramps themselves.
Yeah.
So they're going to be slowing down at that location.
Yeah, but I've been having a hard time visualizing. I'd like to see that design showing where the intersection, what it looked like, but that I think
ground.
I have to, yeah, on the ground
okay.
level.
Well, on the ground is going to be the same as what's there today.
Yeah, and that's
but with a couple of additional.
I've spent enough time thinking
yeah.
about it. But now I see what's going to be, and I say yeah, that's okay because it's going to be slowing down at an intersection,
yeah.
and there's a lot more space. I mean, the space is really good from a bicycle standpoint.
So I guess what Sally has as an option is to endorse with the possibility of looking at how they can mitigate some of the issues that we have with bikes being next to two lanes of through traffic, possibly going 60 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And one of the options she discussed was reducing lanes, which could or could not be an option. I would also like to add to that is possibly having them endorse with that option, that recommendation, but also the recommendation of looking at the crossing across Dreyer Park over to Dreyer Park to the neighborhood, or they're doing the intersection there from a bike and pedestrian standpoint. I think that the threshold is automobiles, and that really needs to be looked up in going across, and also coordinating with the city of West Palm Beach for their bicycle master plan for the integration of the bike lanes along onto Parker. So I think that there's three pieces of that. Into that recommendation, that would be good to endorse with having those other pieces as well.
Yeah, and they continue with this, right? I mean, because
yes.
they're talking about looking at a potential for a pedestrian activated signal.
Right,
you would get, which would mean then you would have a crosswalk and all that at, yeah,
yes,
to get people over there, which is a reasonable way. Say you have some event going on in Durham mm-hmm. Park or something, you're going to need to be able to stop traffic and allow people to cross from the neighborhood into the park.
That aerial shows it right away. There's a big park to the south. There's a neighborhood to the north. That's where pedestrians and bikes need to cross.
Right, and that is something, you know, like I said, that we can incorporate that commitment into our PDE document. And we've become much more strict with our carrying forward our PDE commitments into the design phase because of the fact that the Federal Highway has given authorization to the FDOT to self-authorize documents. But that also comes at a cost to where the DOT has to be much more accountable for the commitments that they make. So now what we do is we have our PD&E commitments. It's called Project Commitment Tracker Record, and we pass it on into design. And so now we're responsible for tracking those commitments all through the design and seeing how they were implemented, who they were implemented by, and then that record goes back to central office and to Federal Highway, and they audit us once a year.
I'd like to clarify that the commitment from DOT would be to look at that intersection and provide some sort of crossing, not necessarily a signalized crossing, because the way it works is you go into the design phase and then there will be a study done to assess the number of pedestrians using this path. And once they do that, they finalize the location, and if they meet the warrant, there's some warrants that need to be met on state roads before we put the signalized intersection or mid-block crossing for pedestrian. But other solutions might be doable, like you said, like a pedestrian overpass or something.
Right.
We can commit
there's options.
To look at that. I just wanted to clarify that that's usually the case. I'm not saying that it can't be done, but that's the way that the process works.
Because the problem needs to be solved, and it's not being solved with this.
Right.
Well, we just need to make sure that it's not ignored.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
We can commit to the issue.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, since there's no quorum, can we just add that on with the process? Okay. So can we? Yeah. Okay. So Sally had. Had a recommendation to endorse with the looking at the buffered bike lanes. Oh wait, what the 7-foot
yeah,
lanes
we want
mean.
A commitment for them to look at the narrowing of lanes and utilization of the 5 feet that would generate to improve the bicycle pedestrian access. Oh, basically east west crossing I-95.
Can I stop there for a second and just get a clarification? So, I think that what I've heard from this discussion is that you're stuck on the bicyclist traveling eastbound on Southern Boulevard, which would be here, approaching I-95.
Yes.
They cross over Lang Road, and then the bicyclist is obligated to navigate this conflict point by moving from the outside curb area to the space in between the three continuous through lanes and the continuous now right turn lane.
Right turn lanes,
yes.
And in this current design with the 12-foot lanes, they're moving into a a 7-foot lane or onto
right.
a...
There's seven is, here,
and then,
and then
there'll
be
6-foot.
Here.
No, there, I think there's 6-foot on the sidewalk,
6-foot
on
the sidewalk.
And, and 7-foot total. But if they...
I'm not
no.
being very careful.
This is the bike lane here, and then the sidewalk is out here.
Right.
Right.
So there's a 6-foot sidewalk and then the 7-foot bike lane.
And a 7-foot bike lane.
Correct.
But if they had instead, if those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lanes instead of being 12-foot lanes were 11-foot lanes, that would give 5 feet within the existing right-of-way to, you know, to play with, either for a better design of the through bike lane or for the possibility of just keep them on the edge and do a better, you know, a wider, you have almost 12 feet, right?
Well, and here's the, this is the point I wanted to raise.
Path that uses
so,
the signal.
If I'm a cyclist, I'm in the roadway,
yeah.
traveling eastbound, and I reach this point right here, I don't know what better facility you could provide for me that would make the crossing of the 1,600 vehicles in an hour that want to go south on 95 more comfortable. I don't know that you could get me to this green space in any
no.
way, shape, or form that I would feel comfortable.
No.
Because I'm crossing so many cars that want to get to these turn lanes.
That's Okeechobee.
But you could,
yeah.
But you could if you take, and that's why I mean that that the recommendation is they look at taking a foot out of each of the lanes
to do what
the five to take the 5 feet to improve the bike pit. I'm not saying that. It
but
has
to improve
go
how?
In the bike
that's
lane.
That's where I'm struggling is because I want to give them some significant content.
Put it in the sidewalk.
You can put
so
it in a multi-use path.
A ramp here so that a cyclist who doesn't want to navigate
yes.
this conflict can go onto this pathway instead?
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, there would be a ramp here where a bicyclist could hop onto the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
However, if we create a 12-foot shared use path, which is what we would have to do, okay, we still have to provide that 7-foot bike lane.
Right.
Yeah,
right. You said that's standard.
Okay. That is.
That is
standard.
And
I navigate that at 50 miles an
yeah.
hour now.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's,
yeah.
it occurs.
That's
I have awesome. Spots on Southern Boulevard
yep.
where I have to, so they're turning off to the right, and I move, we navigate.
So the question is, do you go up on the sidewalk or stay in between all
I would stay, and I, personally, I would just stay on, if I'm going to extend, continue down the bike lane, I'm going to stay in the bike lane.
You would stay in the bike
yeah.
lane?
Yeah.
And then I think that a lot of people would feel more comfortable in not driving.
There are people that would pull off, and it's what's really important. She just said that
mm-hmm.
if there's a ramp that I could use, and I really was feeling uncomfortable. There's like really, really a lot of cars going. There's really fast. I mean, I'd like to have a place I can bail out and be there because I'd only have to go ride down the multi-use path to the light. And then go and then walk and just wait until the light changes.
So
the one thing that might be,
you'll
have to keep in mind though is that since we have to keep that 7-foot bike lane regardless of what we do, any addition that you do to the sidewalk is going to be right away taken.
Well, they're saying
lane
width down to 11.
So
we have to look at right. We have to back up the size of me just to make sure, but I think we can. So
we can play with that.
Yeah,
and that would give you 11-foot sidewalks.
Yes.
So
that would increase.
We would need 12 for shared use path.
But you would still have. I mean, if you could put a ramp on it and have 11, or get the bike path down to 6, then you would have your 12, and you'd have your shared use path. So then you can get 5 out of there, 1 out of there, and then you could have your shared use path.
Well, we'd have to take a look at that because, again, once we get into reconstruction, we're held to certain standards that
right.
we have to follow.
Of course.
And we are acquiring right away
yeah.
in that area. So
when did the shared use go back up to 12? Because it had gone to 12 and then gone back down to 10. So has it gone back up to 12 again?
No,
I think
it was
8.
Yeah.
I thought it was
8.
Sure.
Then it went to
12. But it was 10.
You
can go. Brett always brought up. He would always push towards 12, and
yes.
it's always where you wanted.
Yes,
but
12 is
right. Again, these are these, I mean, if we can go to 10, that's great. I mean, again, these are final design type decisions mm-hmm. that we usually don't, you know, focus on.
Right.
Any. But, I mean, like I said, those are the types of things that can be done.
Which is really why my recommendation is that they make a commitment to look at the narrowing of the lanes and
sure.
take that 5 feet to improve. And I don't want to make a suggestion right here and now about how that improvement would go, whether it's going to a shared use path or a
it's probably
whatever.
But
I
suggest that you add to the clarification that that would be done during the design phase, not the PME phase. Remember
well,
that.
This is something that we would, of course, we would have to coordinate very closely with the city.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
The
yeah.
same as the
yeah.
as how you're going to get bicycle pedestrian access
yeah.
across and into the park. And I know that there's certain standards for the amount of usage, but if the city has a plan for a bicycle path crossing or whatever to go into Dreher Park already, then you can get signalization even if you don't currently have that pedestrian use. Because I have a mid-block flashing crosser for a multi-use trail, and there was
mm-hmm.
nobody on that trail before we built it because
right.
it
before we built it.
Right. As long as it's plain,
there's absolutely no access.
Right.
So that's
I mean, it makes sense if we're in the area doing the work. Put it in now.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's, and my understanding is what you do is you put in the commitment that you're going to look at this and then you figure out
correct
how to best do it.
Correct.
And that's what I would want to see would be, you know, that you make the commitment. You're going to look
mm-hmm.
at narrowing the lanes and putting that footage into improved
yeah.
bicycle
right.
pedestrian.
And that commitment would strictly be on the west side of I-95 because we've already done that on the east side of I-95.
Yeah, it
yeah.
looks to me on the east side. The problem on the east side was that access into Dreher Park.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's an overpass, an activated signal, or something.
Right.
Well, and a commitment that bike and pedestrian crossing will be addressed. I mean,
yes.
that's the commitment. It's not that we'll look at it. It's
no,
that
it
will be addressed.
Have to be reevaluated and addressed,
yes.
Yes.
Then the commitment to coordinate with the city for Parker Avenue for bike and pedestrian facilities.
Correct.
Correct.
I mean, I think that's from our committee, that's the sort of thing I'm comfortable with because I think they've done a good job trying to address this, tackling the problem of moving the traffic.
We need to vote on that or just endorse with the three suggestions and then I think everyone is agreement for endorsement except
mm-hmm.
the city of West Palm Beach based on final design coordination.
We don't have consensus.
Consensus minus one.
Minus
yeah.
one. Consensus minus one. Okay? Good. Okay, and then we're going to information items. We're a little bit behind, so we'll go through these pretty quickly.
Very quickly.
Okay,
3A, 3A will be deferred to October.
Okay.
3B, that is just, it was provided in your backup material. It's strictly the calendar of committee meetings and field board governing meetings for next year. And then 3C, the summary points from the last field board meeting were provided in your packet. You need to review at your leisure.
Thank you. Administrative items. Any member comments?
Bob?
You know, it's like one of the
top oh, wow.
Are you okay? No? Okay. So our next meeting is October 5th. I can't wait to see everyone. And we're adjourned.